Call the Employee Benefits Programs Committee to order. And we don't have to take the roll today. So we will start. We ask Fay Kopp to come back today and to give us an update on her meeting.
Yes. Thank you, and good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Fay Kopp, Chief Retirement Officer and Deputy Director for the Retirement Investment Office, which administers the TFFR retirement program. Certainly at yesterday's committee meeting, you did make a couple of requests of the TFFR board for some actuarial information. At the board's meeting yesterday, we did discuss that. And due to some concerns that the board has related to the cost of some of this requested information, we are going to be limited in the amount of information we are going to be able to provide to the committee. As it relates, first of all, to the projections of TFFR's funding level, assuming active member population growth in the future, we will certainly work with DPI and Siegel, the plan's actuary, to determine how the potential active member population growth, what impact that would have on the plan. And we will certainly work to provide you with additional projections on that. However, this may be somewhat limited in scope because to incorporate an awful lot of detail is, of course, going to require an additional amount of actuarial work. And so we do want to, you know, not go way beyond this and turn this into a $10,000 cost item or something of that nature. But we do believe we will be able to provide you with the information that you've requested as kind of an extension of what of the board's valuation report. As it relates to the second request related to the actuarial impact on the trust fund, if plan provisions were modified to change the current 5-year final average salary calculation to a 10-year final average calc or a career final average calc, the board would prefer to wait until a bill draft is actually developed. And then once that is, of course, provided to the committee and the committee would take jurisdiction over it, then we would certainly, as is required by state law, we would get the actuarial valuation, get the actuarial report on that particular request. So again, the board being very concerned as fiduciaries of the trust fund in the cost of this types of actuarial information, just wants to make sure that we follow you know, the appropriate process, particularly as it relates to the second request. So I did want to share that information with you and communicate to you that the board, you know, greatly appreciates and respects this committee's work as it relates to reviewing any proposed legislation and its impact on the retirement systems of the state.
Okay, thank you. Any questions or comments? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, then we'll go to what's that? Okay, Mr. Miller, we won't make you bounce up and down yesterday as much.
Promises.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, my name is Scott Miller. I am the Executive Director of the North Dakota Public Employees Retirement System. I'm here just basically to give you an update on what we've been up to most recently. We'll go over the health renewal, health plan renewal. We'll go over quite a few of the other things that we've been doing in the past year, I guess. I have to tell you, I mean, I've been the executive director since May, and the amount of work that this staff does on behalf of the state and its employees is amazing to me. It's truly amazing. I hope by the end of my presentation you agree that that there is never a dull day in my office, that is for sure. In response to some of the questions yesterday regarding, I think it was Representative Boehning had asked questions about the health plan and requested some information. We've actually, just to show what my staff does, my overachieving chief operating officer created a PowerPoint on some of the options for the health plan that if you'd like to take a look at after my presentation, she would be happy to come up. We've got it loaded up onto the laptop for
we will do that.
Your viewing. We did not have that printed off. You do have my present. Okay, overachieving. So she did print it off and bring it in. And you also have my presentation in front of you as well. So without further ado, we'll get right into the health plan renewal. This is the statutory guidance regarding the renewal. It's in North Dakota Century Code Section 5452.105, and this is out of subsection 2, which guides the renewal process for the board. You can see that the board may renew a contract if the board determines the carrier's performance under the existing contract meets the board's expectations and the proposed premium renewal amount does not exceed the board's expectations. And then in making those determinations, we need to use a consultant to independently prepare a renewal estimate. So that's how we compare the premium expectations. And then sub B2, we review the carrier's performance measures. We do quite a few surveys. We have them do a survey. We do our own survey. We look into the their performance metrics. We have performance guarantees that they have to meet. And that goes into the determination whether or not we're going to renew. And then sub B3, we consider any additional information that the board determines relevant to making that determination. And that's a number of things, and we'll go over just a few of those. So when the board reviewed the statutory guidance regarding the renewal, they found that, one, the survey showed that Sanford Health Plan's performance was generally ahead of where it was 2 years ago and was meeting the board's expectations. If you remember 2 years ago, there was also a renewal. We did some of the same surveys. The survey results this biennium were much higher than they were last biennium, improving by around 10% across the board. Sanford's proposed premium renewal amounts were consistent with the board's expectations, as guided again by our insurance consultant, Deloitte. And in reviewing the relevant considerations, they weighed in favor of renewing. The managed care efforts that I briefly discussed yesterday and that we'll talk a little bit more about today, had we not renewed and gone out to bid, we may lose those efforts. The current reserve level is moving downward because we had to use about $20 million of the reserve to buy down the premium, and we're going to talk about that in a few minutes as well. And then the potential member disruption, as we had talked about again yesterday. So that's what they found in regard to the statute, the statutory guidance and requirements. On September 25th, the third board meeting in September, the North Dakota PERS board unanimously voted to approve Sanford Health Plan's renewal proposal. The approval was for a 13.1% increase for the NDPERS renewal and a 7% increase for the Medicare supplement. In comparison, the board's consultant, Deloitte, projected a 13.3% increase for the NDPERS renewal, so the renewal amount is actually below what that projection was, and they also projected a 7% increase for the Medicare supplement, so that was right on point. Sanford also agreed to implement several additional programs if the board requests that are designed to bring down the trend, and again, we'll talk about those. I'll talk about one of them, and Sharon will talk about the other.
Quick question, those increases, those are biennium totals, are they not?
That is correct.
Thank you.
That's correct. Over the course of the next several months, and of course through the legislative session, we will be working with Sanford to finalize any changes to the insurance. So that 13.1% increase is the plan that we currently have right now. If we are not appropriated, or the state agencies are not appropriated the necessary amount to pay for that premium, then of course we need to make modifications to the plan in order to get to the premium that you ultimately appropriate. And so that's a kind of a process that takes place through the legislative session, and once we know what that appropriated amount will be, then we can finalize what the plan will look like. And that's just the last bullet, I guess. All right. So one thing to keep in mind, as I'd mentioned, we are currently buying down the premium, which means we're using our reserves to pay a part of the premium. The actual 2017-19 biennium premium is $1,265 and change. We are buying that down by about $27.32 a contract. So what state agencies are paying is that 12, is that, sorry, John, I didn't mean to blast you, is that 1240.82 right there. Well, the 13.1% increase is in relation to what we pay Sanford. So that goes from 1265 up to 1431, a 13.1% increase. However, since we've spent $20 million of our reserves. We're projected to be around $25 million in reserves at the end of this biennium. We may not be able to buy down the premium the same amount. If we don't use any buy down premium dollars, the new 1431.10 premium, if you add in our $2.80 administrative charge, goes up to 1433.90. And the difference between the 1240 and the 1433 is actually a 15.5% increase. So even though it's a 13.1% increase in what we're paying to Sanford, that was the agreed renewal amount, the amount that we'll be charging state agencies if there's no change whatsoever, and if we're not able to buy down the premium, would instead be that 15.56%. And so it's a little bit different, saying a 13.1 as far as what we're paying Sanford and what we're actually going to be increasing the premium to state agencies if there's not a change. And again, Sharon has a great deal of information, as you can see, on the variety of plan options that we're looking at in order to try to bring that down. One of those I'll actually talk about very shortly. This is what the additional cost will be to the state if we do have the same exact plan with that 13.1% increase. Total additional state funds would be about $73 million, and total additional general funds would be about $40 million. And so the difference in the premiums for this biennium is about $472 million. For next biennium, again, assuming no changes, is $545 million. So those are some of the numbers that you had requested from yesterday. We also did so in addition to the health plan renewal, we also had to go through a Medicare Part D renewal, or the Part D is the prescription drug coverage for Medicare eligible retirees. The initial indications were that the premium would remain flat for 2019. We got our provider, ESI or Express Scripts, they're our pharmacy benefit manager that provides this product for us. We got them on the phone, talked to them about the premiums and how they affect our retirees, and asked them to do whatever they could to sharpen their pencils. They did so. They sharpened their pencil down to the nub and came down with a reduction in the premium of 9.8%. They also provided us a quote to add in an additional opioid management program for an additional 26 cents, the board believing that that is imperative in today's society, agreed to add that opioid management program into the ESI contract. And so the board approved renewing with ESI with the opioid management program. The premium was reduced from $95.38 a month to $86.26, a 9.6% reduction because of that extra 26 cents. The new premium will save our retirees almost $1 million in 2019. We were very happy to be able to do that for our retirees. And here's where the general stuff is, other North Dakota PERS initiatives going forward. We have a diabetes prevention program pilot. This is for individuals who have been identified as at risk for acquiring diabetes. Once you have it, it's a little bit more difficult to get rid of it than it is to keep it from affecting you to begin with. That has a series of meetings that people need to sign up to go to. It has, frankly, weight loss aspirations in order to get their weight down. Weight is a very high indicator of the potential for diabetes and a number of other things. And we're happy to report that we are, it's only a pilot right now. There are only three groups around the state that are participating. And we've been able to successfully bring down, on average, their collective weight by over 5%, which is, I wish I could lose 5%, I'll tell you that. We also have an About the Patient Diabetes Program structure change. So the About the Patient Diabetes Program is for people who have diabetes, who weren't successful in staving off the disease. And this is to help them, help ensure that they stay on their medication, on their treatment plan. Well, the way that we had it, if they came in and went to three meetings with their pharmacist right off the bat, they were good for the entire year, but there was no monitoring of that for the entire year. And so what the structure change is now they have to go and see their pharmacist once every 4 months. And if they see their pharmacist, they engage with their pharmacist in the necessity and the imperative nature of staying with their treatment program, then they remain in the program. And what that does is that takes away some of the copays for their diabetes treatment, for their prescriptions and that type of thing. We are also happy to report that has been very successful as well. We're really looking forward to the new structure that will start on January 1st of 2019. We also added an applied behavioral analysis coverage to our health insurance plan. That's for treatment of autism spectrum disorders. I don't know if you know, the insurance department a few months ago issued a bulletin advising insurers within the state that if you cover any autism spectrum disorders, you have to provide this coverage. And so we did not offer the coverage. The board decided that that's given the insurance department's mandate, that's something we should cover. We talked with Sanford about the cost of adding that coverage for the biennium, and Sanford has agreed to absorb that cost for this biennium, and then of course going forward in the next biennium with the renewal that will be that is built into that premium price. That went into effect on October 1st. I have a close relative who's on the autism spectrum. I'm very happy that these folks will be getting some additional care going forward. We've also been considering, we're still in the middle of this consideration of whether to unbundle the Medicare Supplement and Part D coverages. So this is for Medicare eligible retirees. Right now we only offer a bundled plan. So in order to have the Part D coverage through the state, you also have to have our Medicare Supplement through the state, through NDPERS, and vice versa. What we've seen is there's an awful lot of advertising, especially toward the end of the year, to try to get retirees to switch over to a different Part D plan. A lot of times they'll do that because it might save them $5, $10, $15, whatever it is a month. But when they do that, they lose our Medicare Supplement because it's a bundled plan. They have to have both, and you can't have two Part D coverages. And so when that happens, then we work with them to say, you know, are you sure that you want to do this? Because now you need to find Medicare Supplement. What the board is considering is unbundling so that someone can take either the Medicare Supplement or the Part D or both. And we're still in the middle of those considerations. We're also exploring other options for our Medicare Supplement plan. Right now we have what's called a look-alike plan, or a Plan F look-alike. There's a G that's coming out, Plan G, that actually in the private sector, they're going to have to move over to the G at some point. For state, since we offer a look-alike Plan F, we don't have to stop offering that. We can offer Plan G, and the difference is a little bit of cost, some of the deductibles that are covered by one and not the other. And so we're looking into whether to offer a Plan G, transition out of the Plan F, that type of thing. And so a lot of different considerations for our retirees going on in front of the board right now.
Senator Larson.
Mr. Chairman, if I could interrupt in just a minute. You're talking about unbundling the plans. We're coming up onto the enrollment cycle. Is that going to be this year, or are we talking next year?
That would be for next year.
Next year, okay.
Yeah,
thank
for
you.
2020. We also have in the main PERS plan, we have an opioid management program as well. Of course, we just started, or we're going to start offering that to our Part D moving forward. We had a presentation at the board meeting last week by ESI, our Express Scripts, our pharmacy benefit manager, about the effectiveness of that program just to this point. We've saved hundreds of thousands of dollars on opioids, but more importantly, we have taken the long-acting opioids out of the hands of people that don't need them. There are a lot of people who are getting prescribed, unfortunately, primarily by dentists, my understanding, long-acting opioids when a short-acting opioid is what you actually need. When you go in and get a root canal, if you have some acute pain that pops up, you don't need an opioid that's going to work for you for 24 hours. You just need to deaden that pain right now. And ensuring that people don't have access to those long-acting opioids, because those are the ones that hurt. When you ingest one of those, that sticks with you for quite some time. And if you take another drug that conflicts with that, you can actually overdose without even really knowing it. And that's part of the reason that we're having this opioid overdose epidemic right now. And so we were very excited to see the results of the report from ESI, or Pharmacy Benefit Manager, about getting those long-acting drugs out of the hands of people who don't need them.
Senator Becquerel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Scott, I just want to make one correction there. Being a dentist and practicing in the state for 35 years, we were responsible for about 8% of the opioid prescriptions statewide. We put in a program at the governor's request last year and reduced the number of those prescriptions by 75% in the year. So I think we've done a pretty massive job there. But I think when you talk about dentists as a whole, you need to talk about oral surgeons in general with the opioids. They're a small percentage of the practice, but they write the largest percentage of the scripts for the pain relief medications. So when you look at, when you look like I do on the prescription management website, what I find is I write a script for 12 Vicodin or a similar drug like that for minor pain relief for 2 or 3 days, and the family practitioners for long-term pain management, in the, looking at the records, are putting those prescriptions out for 120 days. So it's by volume and by incident numbers, the dental community is pretty, a pretty small percentage of that, but just a clarification if you want to take that.
Thank you very much. I do appreciate that. We didn't get that detail, so I appreciate that. Thank you. So again, we're very excited about what that's doing. We're saving the plan some significant money, and also hopefully saving some lives out there. The total cost of care. This is one of those wellness programs that I talked about that was one of the ancillary things that the board looked at when renewing. We've been working with Sanford Health Plan on a couple of different welfare programs, welfare management programs, and the total cost of care is one that the board actually just approved last week to begin in on July 1 of 2019. What the total cost of care is a value-based or managed care option where Sanford will go out and contract with the primary carriers across the state. And that agreement is for the primary care physician to basically agree to take control of the management, the healthcare management of their patients. And if they're able to do so in a highly efficient manner, which is designed to not only reduce costs but increase the efficiency and to increase the welfare of their patients and their members, and if there is our savings that result from that, we're actually going to share part of that savings with them. If on the other hand they're not able to do that, if they're not providing efficient services and costing the plan money, they're actually going to pay us some of that. And so this is an overlay program that is invisible to the patients at large. So I won't know if my primary care physician is in this program or not. I would hope that he is, but I won't know. It's basically transparent to the folks that are receiving those benefits. But behind the scenes, the physicians are going to be taking more responsibility for effectively managing the care that's being provided to their patients. And we're hoping that that will ultimately bend the trend down that we've been seeing. Sanford estimates that it will actually save us a little over 5% on our premiums going forward. And then third, a pharmacy benefit manager transition. So Sanford basically went out to bid this year to see what was out in the marketplace to provide their pharmacy benefit manager services to our health plan. They had have ESI Express Scripts. They made the decision to move to Optum Rx starting January 1st, I believe. And that is projected to save our plan between $5 and $6 million because of the difference in some of the contracting with Optum Rx. So we're very happy that Sanford is also taking a deep interest in being able to maintain the costs that we have for the coverage of state employees.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chairman and Scott, with the switch over from Express Scripts to Optum, will that cause problems with the clients that, for instance, are going to CVS now? Will they have to make any changes and go maybe to whatever, Walgreens or someplace else?
My understanding is that Optum Rx currently has contracts with every one of the providers that has a contract with ESI. Last time I heard, except for two. and that is still accurate. So, and they're reaching out to make sure that they can still contract with those two. So every other pharmacist in the state has a contract with OptumRx. Any other questions? All right. Moving on, our long-term care plan. We have very few people that take advantage of long-term care, which is unfortunate because that's one of the bigger benefits for folks. But because of the administrative cost of taking care of that plan and the fact that we have very few people that take advantage of it, the board did decide to discontinue that long-term care plan effective 1-1 of 2019. Last year, we also did an RFP for our dental plan. We had a couple of finalists that we had in before the board, and Delta Dental, which is our current provider, was awarded a new contract. And so, as we typically do, it's a contract for a two-year period with two-year renewal possibilities. We also did an RFP for our FlexComp provider. FlexComp is that pre-tax program that we have for both healthcare and for taking care of your children, where you get money taken out of your check on a pre-tax basis. It gets put into your account, and then you submit your claims over the course of the year, and you get that money back. You end up saving basically your taxes on it. We had WageWorks up until now, and we are transitioning to a new carrier, ASI Flex. They will take over on January 1st of 2019. We're very excited for that. ASI Flex is actually the one that's taking care of our retiree health insurance credit funds right now, as far as processing those claims. And they've been really easy to work with in that circumstance. They've been really easy to work with as far as this transition.
Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chairman and Scott, going back to long-term care, you said you didn't have a lot of people enrolled in it, but those that were enrolled in it, what happened to them?
They are able to continue with that insurance if they like on a self-pay basis. We just won't be administering it anymore. So they still have access to it. And then finally, the retirement plan employer participation. This is a bit in response to the two bills that you took jurisdiction over yesterday that will close the plan for either the state employees or for the state and political subdivision employees. Just to let you know, we still have a great deal of interest from political subdivisions across the state seeking to join our defined benefit plan. Over the course of the past 10 years, we've had 51 new employers come on. Currently, we have four employers that are projected to enroll in 2019, bringing in an additional 480 people within the retirement system. So we are still actually a growing system. What we're going to do going forward is make sure that these folks understand that they may come into a plan that might get closed, because there are costs to exiting our system as well. And so we thought that it was important to let you know that we still continue to get recognition by the political subdivisions across the state and the benefit of having a defined benefit plan. And that is the extent of my comments. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I forgot that we added this. This is a follow-up from yesterday, and I may actually turn this over to Sharon as well. You'd asked for the fiscal note for the fourth year of the recovery plan, and so I'll have Sharon come up and discuss that with you. And let me know if you have any questions.
Any other questions of Scott? Okay, Sharon.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Sharon Schirmeister, the Chief Operating Officer at North Dakota PERS. This slide is just in follow-up to Representative Boehnings. I had covered this verbally yesterday as to the fiscal effect of the contribution increase, the 1% employer increase and 1% employee increase. This is just a copy of that so that you have that. I know, Representative Boehnings, you also had asked for more specific on Cass County, but we'll work on that today. We didn't have time yesterday to get that information, but we'll forward that to you as well. And so what this just shows is what the cost is to the employer. The top part shows the cost to the state, broken out between general funds and other funds for the next biennium and then the following biennium. And then in section B, it shows the cost for the different political subdivisions. And again, that's just the same numbers we had provided yesterday, but just in written format for you. And I'll pull up the, what I have for you is the handout. It's called Andy Purr's Health Plan, but you may want to pull it up because some of the numbers are small.
And I'll double check that this should be linked again on our agenda.
It should be linked on our agenda.
Yeah, hopefully.
Refresh. Not you, but on the agenda, if you've got yesterday's agenda open, if you refresh it, it should activate the hyperlink.
What we thought might be helpful for the committee is to give you just some background of where our health plan is with the current plan design and just some information. We're not going to go through each of these, but just some talking points. This is information that we also provided to the State Employee Compensation Commission for their meeting, which was a month ago, actually, today. And so just to give you a little background, this is our current plan design for the Andy Purr's Dakota plan, our PPO basic plan. And what we show is that basically the plan design stayed the same for several bienniums, but for the current biennium, we did have benefit changes that did go into place in order, if you recall, with the increase that came in for this biennium, the legislature funded that premium at a lower level. In order to meet that lower level, we did some plan design changes, which reduced the premium by close 4.5% about, and that included raising deductibles and some of the coinsurance maximums and copays.
Sure.
And then we also...
From you. Who makes the changes to the plan? Does the PERS board do it? How does that process work?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. How that works is it kind of goes back, starts with statute, because in the statute it says that the state will pay for the full premium of family coverage. So when the premium is appropriated by the legislature for the amount of premium that you're willing to fund, we know that that has to buy a family contract. And so from that, the PERS board then takes a look at whether that will pay for the current plan of benefits. If not, then we need to look at different plan designs. So ultimately, the PERS board is responsible for working with the carrier to come up with a plan design. But what we do in advance, like today, and we've provided the same information up to the Office of Management and Budget, and I'm sure that's also going to the governor's office, just giving you a perspective of what would need to happen if different funding levels were approved, so that it's apparent, because some people may think that just raising a deductible by $50 or something could achieve a lot of savings. So we try to model some different plan designs to give the policymakers some idea of what type of plan the dollars that are being put in the budget can buy.
Thank you.
Okay.
Senator Dever.
Mr. Chairman, Sharon, if I could follow up with that. In the last session, I believe that the increase in premiums was funded in three different ways.
Yeah.
One of those was through an appropriation. Another was through funds from the reserve fund. And the third was the design plan change. It's important for people to know that that's not the first time we've done the design plan change, and that Sanford was not responsible for that. It's a decision made by the PERS board following action of the legislature. I think there was some confusion last time. So as we go forward into the next session, and the money that we took out of the reserve fund, we need to either take the same amount of money out of the reserve fund again or pay that much more out of the appropriation.
Continue.
Okay. And I concur with what Senator Dever said, that the increase last time was funded by an increased appropriation, the plan design changes, which are shown here on this chart, and then also there was a component about close to 2.5% of the premium was bought down. And Scott had a slide in his presentation just showing how that translates and how now if we don't continue buying down the premium, you know, the increase to the state is more going to be around 15.5% instead of 13. So some things that we've been looking at to help to provide options to the policymakers is that, you know, currently we have one premium for all types of plans. We have our fee-for-service plan, which is the PPO basic, but we also have the high-deductible health plan. From a state perspective, the premium is the same there because what's happening is it's a lower premium that we pay to Sanford, but the difference is defined in statute that the difference between the premium and what's being paid is going into a health savings account, so the employer is making that. So right now, the plan that the state is buying, it's the same premium no matter which option that the employee takes. We are looking at a new plan option that could come in with a lower premium. It's something we worked with Sanford on, and at this time, you know, no decisions have been made because until we know where the funding is, we're not sure which options we're going to exercise. But one thing that did come forward is that we could look at a plan design with a North Dakota focused provider network option. And later in the slides, I'll kind of show you what that looks like. But essentially it would be where people would need to get their care within the state of North Dakota. If they needed to go out of state, they could do so with a referral from their provider. If they choose to self-refer, they can still get the services out of state, but they would pay a higher cost share, so it's not prohibiting it. But that's something that the actuary from Sanford has come back to us, just showing that there are certain things that can definitely be done cheaper in state that some people may choose to go out of state for. And so it was just an option that we're looking at as a way to help manage costs and possibly have a lower premium. Thirdly, we're looking at the value-based provider payment system, which Scott explained was the total cost of care. And that has shown that the board is going to be moving forward with that. And so that will result in about 0.5% decrease in premium. So when looking at different plan design options, what we did is we came up with a plan design of changes that could be made to our current plan but still maintain our grandfathered status. If you recall, you know, our plan is a grandfathered plan. Some people ask us, why is it important to keep a grandfathered plan? And really, the reason that the PERS board has done is primarily from a cost perspective, because we know that if we were to lose our grandfathered status, the ACA mandated benefits would increase the cost of the plan by 3%. So generally that's been the decision, is that we've had, you know, we've just been trying to fund the current plan we have. But that's not to say losing grandfathered status is a bad thing, because there are a lot of benefits that get added into the plan. So it's really benefit increases. And so I'll talk about that a little later. But this chart just shows what can be done to the current plan design and still maintain grandfathered status. We did most of those changes in the current biennium, but we can still raise the deductible by about $50 and raise the copays by $5. So very, very minor. But we do know that this is can reduce the premium by about right around 1.5% if we made some of these changes. We also looked at some options that we may need to go grandfathered. And the one thing I do also want to mention on the grandfathered status is we do also know that there can be an increase in the employee contribution by up to 5%. You can still maintain grandfathered status, so that's something that's there. But in the event that we would need to go or make further cuts that would require us to go into a non-grandfathered plan, we did have some modeling done to say, okay, well, we know that by adding the additional wellness benefits, birth control is covered at 100%. So there are a number of benefit add-ins. But in order to cover the cost of that, how would we need to change some of the employee cost sharing in the plan? And so this first slide just shows what would need to change in order to neutralize the premium by going to non-grandfathered. And essentially what you're going to see is the out-of-pocket maximums increase. We did an option two on a non-grandfathered two, just saying, okay, if we go non-grandfathered, but we want to get some additional premium reduction, like I think we had projected around 2%, this is where you'd need to go. So again, it's a more dramatic increases, higher deductibles and higher out-of-pockets. And then option three is just another version of that. If we needed to go closer to a 5% reduction in premium, again, just showing how the cost share would need to change in order to achieve those reductions. And then the next slide, slide eight, is just showing the North Dakota Focus Network that I talked about. This is an idea for a plan design there. And like I explained, we know that this would result in some premium reduction. It's just kind of showing a possible plan design on that, on what the cost shares would be. But the thing that we felt was important on this is not to, you know, there are some plans where you just don't get any coverage if you go out of state. We didn't think that was a direction that we would want to pursue. So this one, again, gives people the option to go out of state, but they just have to pay at a higher cost share. And lastly, is with our health plan reserves, we know, like we did this biennium, we can use some of the reserves to buy down the premium increase. Our reserves, just to refresh you, we currently have with our carrier what's called a hybrid fully insured contract. That means that if the plan experiences gains where the premiums are higher than the claims, we share in the first $3 million with the carrier 50-50, but anything above that comes back to PERS. And we've had that arrangement for several years. And through that, that's how we've built our reserve balance. On the flip side, if there's a loss, right now we don't have to worry about any loss. But our reserves are built from those gain sharing provisions in our contracts. And as I pointed there, the last 10 years we've received approximately $50 million through those gain sharing contracts. And we do use that to buy down the premiums to help offset some of the premium increases. Last year, our reserve balance was around $40 million. We are using approximately $15 million. I think Scott rounded that up to 20 when he talked, but it's closer to 15, to the nearest five, I guess. But it's going to be Yeah, so it's closer to $15 million is what we're using this biennium. And so we're projecting to have roughly around $25 million at the end of this biennium that could be available to buy down premiums. We did some projections that if we can get approximately 0.6% reduction in premium for every $5 million in buy down. So every $5 million that would come from the reserves, it would reduce premium by about 0.6. And with that, that's all I had, unless there's any questions.
Any questions or comments for Sharon? As always, very thorough. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any public commentary? That's what I like about early meetings. Okay, we have, does the committee have any discussion? Okay. All right, then we will have our 9 o'clock. Mr. Lance Weiss will give an overview of the PERS valuation process and update us on the funds. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Lance Weiss, a senior consulting actuary with Gabriel Roeder Smith & Company, the actuary for the North Dakota Public Employees Retirement System. It's a pleasure to be here. If you turn to, let's see here. All right, the agenda on page one. So I just wanted to kind of give you a quick overview of what I'm going to talk about with you today. We're going to talk a little bit about the actuarial valuation methodology and background. I've been informed that you've already gone through a lot of this background information with regard to the presentation you had for the teacher's plan yesterday. Is that fairly correct? So I will go through it briefly. I won't bore you again with all of that background information. Hopefully that would be positive. Good. I will, though, tell you a little bit about some of the results, obviously. The funded status results and the contribution, the required contribution results. So those are kind of the key facts that I'll be going through. Then we'll talk about, why the unfunded liability changed from year to year. And then I'll just have some summary comments on each of the various program results. So that's kind of what we're going to talk about today. All right. So the valuation, and again, this is the section that I'm going to go through very quickly. Please, please, please do not hesitate to ask any questions if anything's, unclear. The purpose of an actuarial valuation is to determine the funding status of the plan, how the assets relate to the liabilities, develop the contribution rates, and then compare those to the statutory rates. I should say, develop the actuarial contribution rates and compare those to the statutory rates, and then provide accounting and other data. And currently, under the current accounting standards, we are actually performing a separate actuarial valuation as required by the Government Accounting Standards Board statements, 67 and 68. So in terms of the actuarial evaluation process itself, the left-hand column is the data inputs. The middle column is actually the valuation that we perform. And the right-hand column are all the outputs of the valuation. So we're actually going to go through some of the inputs as I go through this presentation today. We're going to talk about the membership data and how that changed, the asset data. There actually, I'll give you a quick clue here. There were no plan changes, so that's that'll go very quickly. We'll talk a little bit about the actuarial assumptions and methods, and then the funding policy. And as I said, those are the inputs to the actuarial evaluation. We take all those inputs, we perform our evaluation, and then, as I said earlier, the output of that is the funded status, the actuarial contribution rates, and again, compared to the statutory rates, and then the funding information, which we will present in a separate report. So talking about actuarial assumptions, that's kind of the first input. Generally speaking, actuaries break out the assumptions into what we call the economic assumptions, which are your money assumptions, and the demographic assumptions, which are really the people assumptions. So in terms of the economic assumptions, that generally includes investment return, payroll growth rate, population growth. Generally, the board, the actuary, and other advisors select those economic assumptions. In terms of the demographic assumptions, those are rates that determine or predict when people will retire, raises people will get, when people will become disabled, when people will terminate, and when people will die. And generally speaking, the board, the actuary, and staff select those demographic assumptions. In terms of the actuarial assumptions, generally speaking, actuaries recommend that the actuarial assumptions be reviewed at least every 3 to 5 years to make certain that they continue to be appropriate, that they continue to accurately predict future experience. The last experience review that was performed by the prior actuary prior to Gabriel Roeder being assigned to this account, that covered the period from July 1, 2009 through July 1, 2014, and the updated assumptions from that study were first adopted in the July 1, 2015 actuarial valuation. So we've had the 15 valuation, the 16 valuation, the 17 valuation, and now the 18 valuation. We would suggest that either before or after the next valuation that you might entertain performing another experience study. GRS did perform a review of strictly the economic assumptions. We did that in 2017. And the board adopted updated economic assumptions that were first effective with the July 1, 2017 actuarial valuation. So the economic assumptions have been updated more recently. As I mentioned earlier, another input to the valuation is the actuarial cost method. This is the method by which actuaries separate costs from prior service as compared to future service. The actuarial cost method that's been used for all of the plans except for job service is the NTRAGE normal method. This is the most common funding method used across the United States for public sector plans. It's also consistent with the requirement of the Governmental Accounting Standards Board as to which is the appropriate actuarial cost method. The only reason we deviate for job service is because it's frozen and it's very overfunded. So I think you actually had a graph similar to this in the presentation for teachers, but basically what we're saying here is this is the actuarial cost method. The total liability for all the plans, for all the PERS plans, is basically $5.3 billion. So if you had all that money in an account, you'd be good. You'd have enough money. You don't. However, what you do have is assets of about $2.9 billion. The total accrued liability, which is the liability for benefits accrued to date, the total of that is almost $4 billion. You already have assets representing 2.9 of that. So that's where we come up with the 72% funded ratio. Assets represent 72% of the total accrued liability. Now, some of the liability is will be accrued in the future, and that's what we call the future normal cost. So we fund each of those, that future normal cost, through annual normal costs going each and every year in the future. So that's kind of just a real brief summary of, you know, how the actuarial cost method works and how we get to the unfunded liability. As I said, the unfunded liability is the amount of the accrued liability for benefits accrued to date that is that you don't have in the fund, that you haven't funded yet. But the good news is you are 72% funded, which is not bad. In terms of the actuarial value of assets, the board has adopted an actuarial value of assets method, which smooths out deviations in market value. I shouldn't say deviations, fluctuations in market value. So instead of taking market value, which can be, you know, fluctuate pretty, you know, greatly from year to year, we smooth out those fluctuations over a five-year period. And this is kind of a graph of how that's been smoothed out. As I said, the green line is the market value, and you can see it varies a little bit more. The blue line is the smoothed value, where we're smoothing in the fluctuations on a year-by-year basis in market value over 5 years. Theoretically, we want market value and actuarial value to converge at the end of the day. But you can see that's the smoothing effect. And the idea of the smoothing effect is if we used market value as the basis of assets in our valuation, your contribution requirement, your actuarial contribution requirement, would vary dramatically. By using a more smoothed actuarial value of assets, we're able to take that actuarial contribution requirement and keep it a little bit more level. That's the whole purpose of using a smoothed actuarial value. In terms of, you know, causes of the unfunded liability, the primary one is not contributing at least normal cost plus interest on the unfunded liability. So if you have an unfunded liability, it's very similar to a mortgage. You want to pay interest on that so it doesn't increase. But then what you are accruing during the year is the normal cost, which is benefits that are accruing for each and every person in the plan during that year. So if you pay the normal cost, which is the benefits accruing, and you pay interest on the unfunded, that unfunded will not grow. Other causes of unfunded, basically it's actuarial experience which is less favorable than assumed. So it's actuarial experience that deviates from our actuarial assumptions. So for example, good examples here are lower rates of investment return. You know, if the fund earns less than what we've assumed, that's a loss. That'll increase the unfunded liability. If people get raises that are higher than what we've assumed, that will also increase the unfunded liability, and other examples here. And then granting initial benefits or granting benefit increases for service already rendered, that's generally speaking, you know, a big part of the original unfunded liability. All right. So we're going on to funding policy. I'm still looking at all the inputs to the, yes,
Senator
question.
Senator Becadal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question on the higher salary increases. As the salaries increase, don't the percentages of paid dollars to the fund increase as well?
Yes.
From the employer and employee aspect?
Yes.
But they're never high enough to take into account coverage of the benefits then at the end of the term? It's never enough to compensate for that?
Yes. Generally speaking, what we do in an actuarial evaluation is take each and every member in the plan and we use our salary scale and predict when they're going to, what their benefit will be when they're predicted to retire. So if you enter the plan at 25 and according to the actuarial assumptions, you're expected to retire, let's say at age 60, with all the decrements throughout that period, and we're predicting that you're going to get 3% raises every year, we'll come up with that actual projected benefit, you know, piece, the benefit amount. We then discount that back to the valuation date and say, okay, if we put in this level percentage of pay today, that'll accumulate, you know, each and every year. If we pay that amount, let's say 10% of pay each and every year, that'll get us enough money to pay that projected benefit. So if we go, you know, if we're assuming 3% raises throughout someone's career and they actually get 5% raises, we're going to be short. So you want to increase that unfunded liability such that we amortize it so that the money is there at the end of the day.
So there is no magic percentage number of employee and employee contributions, employee and employer contributions on a percentage basis that take care of that long term. In other words, as the salaries increase, that number is sufficient to keep the same coverage in the plan to cover them at the end?
Well, we'll calculate the actuarial contribution rate, and so that's going to vary each and every year based on deviations, okay, you know, to salary, for example. So this year, it may be, let's say, 10%. If raises are granted that are in excess of what we've predicted, that 10% actuarial contribution rate may rise to 10.5. And so we'll do an actuarial evaluation each and every year, and we'll come up with that actuarial contribution rate each and every year. And we know it's not going to be perfect. We know it's not going to ever equal 10% each and every year. But we'll vary that based on, as I said, you know, examples like this, higher salary.
Now I understand why you want to do this about every 3 to 5 years, because these things do change.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. All right. So in terms of the current funding policy, the employee-employer contribution rates are fixed based on fixed rates, and the fixed rates are on this graph, page 12, the employer rate and the employee rate. So the current funding policy to determine the actuarial contribution rate, again, we pay normal cost, which is the cost of benefits accruing during the year that we're doing the valuation, and then we amortize the unfunded liability. And as I said earlier, it's just like a mortgage. You're paying off that unfunded liability. In this case, we're paying it off for the main system judges, public safety and highway patrol over 20 years, and for RHIC over 40 years. And this is just the policy. It's not currently applicable for job service due to the large surplus in this plan. So what we're trying to do is come up with a level percentage of pay. As I said earlier, you know, my example was 10%. We're hoping that, you know, the contribution will hover around 10% each and every year, but deviations from our assumptions, other issues that I mentioned earlier in terms of, you know, what causes the unfunded to grow, those can also factor into that change in the, you know, again, my example is 10%, but that change in the contribution rate from year to year. Last but not least, changes in plan provisions. I already gave you a hint. There have been no new changes in plan provisions since the last actuarial evaluation as of July 1, 2017. Okay, so the final input item is the demographic data, and we just wanted to give you a quick idea of, you know, the input. Again, this is an input.
Representative Bainey.
Thank you. If we can go back to slide 13.
Sure.
You're talking payroll is assumed to increase at 3.75% each year, but the last year there was no raises, so how do you account for that?
It's based on the total number of employees. So if you have more employees, we're assuming that the total payroll grows at that amount. So it's growth in population as well as raises.
Okay, then the other...
And that's and I should mention too, that's an average. That's not meant to be, you know, actual year to year. That's our expectation, and that's one of the issues that we would look at when we do a new actuarial experience analysis is to determine whether that assumption, you know, continues to be appropriate or not.
And the other question, Mr. Chairman, would be, we're not having an increase, we're having a decrease in employees currently from the last.
Let's go through. Let's go through, because that's actually the graph I've got, or the table I've got here. So you can see, you know, and this is the, so we're starting here with the PERS plan. We'll go to the other plans on page 17, but on page 16 is the PERS plan. And you can see, so active members actually increase. And again, we collect data as of July 1, 2017 and July 1, 2018. So those are the, you know, the census dates that we use. And so you can see active members and their PERS increased from 23,243 to 23,483, so about a 1% increase. Retired members increased about 5%. Vested former members increased 4.6. So in total, for the PERS plan between 2017 and 2018, the total population increased 3%. The average age, about 46.3, didn't change very much at all. Same thing with average service. And then salary, the total base salary went up about 1.2%. So that's the 1.2 compared to, you know, the prior assumption that we were making. So that's something we would have to continue to look at when we do the actuarial experience, the next actuarial experience analysis. And then retiree benefits, as I mentioned, retirees went up about 5.4%. The number of retirees went up 5.4%. Benefits went up about 10.7%. And the average annual benefit went up about 5%, which is probably to be expected because you have new retirees who are, you know, retiring with higher salaries and they're going to get higher benefits. So that average annual benefit is probably going to creep up, continue to creep up. Let's go to Highway Patrol, Job Service, and RHIC. So if you look at Highway Patrol, active members went up about 2%. Retirees stayed the same. Vested former members went up 7.7. So in total, the population for Highway Patrol went up 1.9%. Job Service, it's, you know, it's a frozen plan, so it actually went down. You went from 8 actives to 7 actives over the course of the year. And in RHIC, the active population increased 1.1%. And then the total population for RHIC, including retirees, increased 2.4%. Any questions? I know you had mentioned you were expecting a decrease.
Well, yeah.
Representative Beeny.
Thank you. But I guess when I look at the numbers, that it's just not the state employees and it's more involved in that. So that's why this number has gone up. Our numbers are going
up. I see. Okay, I see.
Not on the whole in government, though.
And when you look at these plan, the members in the plan, right?
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so now let's get to the results. This is, you know, this is what I trust you're actually looking at and primarily focusing at. So we've got the funded ratio results for all plans. And you can see across, you know, the rows here, the columns, main system judges, public safety with prior service, public safety without prior main service, Highway Patrol, Job Service, and RHIC. So if you look at the bottom, I mean, you can look at the graphs, you know, the blue lines, and you can see that, for example, main system went, the funded ratio increased slightly. And if you look at the bottom rows, the funded ratio increased from 69.9% to 71.6% for main system, which is obviously the largest system. It increased for judges from 117% funded to 124% funded. It increased for both of the public safety plans, increased for Highway Patrol. The only plan that it didn't increase for was Job Service. And again, that's the frozen unfunded plan. And so we actually lowered the investment return assumption for that plan based on a change in the asset allocation. So that's the reason there. That's kind of a odd reason, but that's the deviation there. And then it also increased for RHIC. So to me, you know, as your actuary, I look at this and say, the trend is in the right direction. That's where we look at as actuaries, is the trend going in the right direction? Is that funded ratio, you know, going upward, and is it approaching 100%? And so from an actuarial point of view, I say this is good news. I hope that you view that as well. All right. In terms of actuarial value and market value, as I mentioned earlier, we're using, you know, I don't want to call it an artificial value, but it's an actuarial value, which smooths out gains and losses. In terms of, you know, the money in the fund is the market value. So you can see here, you know, it's pretty close. The difference between, the difference on the funded ratio between actuarial and market is relatively close. So that's the good news. There's no big differences. All right, now we're going to contribution rate results. Any questions on the funded ratio results I should mention, ask?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Deber.
That's $2.5 billion in the plan. And the unfunded, or the current liability is $1.09 billion more than that. If we were to make a cash infusion into the plan, how much would that need to be? Do you have any ideas?
Let's go back to let's see here, it's slide 8. So we'll go back there. So slide 8, this is, you know, kind of your plan. The present value of benefits is 5.2, but that's total including future. In terms of the actual accrued liability, it's the number on the top on my top left. So it's the 3.959. That's your total accrued liability. Of that, you have assets at 2.869. So what you would need to contribute to get to 100% funded is the unfunded liability of $1.09 billion.
But
continue.
That's the current accrued liability. If everybody in the system retired today.
Right. Right? Yes.
You don't need that money until they do retire.
Correct.
So if we were to make a cash infusion today, wouldn't it be less than that?
Yes. Yes. Hopefully that that is the present value, though. That is the present value. So we've already done the present value calculation. So that is actually the number you would need. Now, again, they aren't going to retire today. You're right. So you won't need all that money, but you're going to have gains and losses along the way that could potentially increase or decrease that number. But you're absolutely right. You won't need that, you know, you don't need to be 100% funded today because not everyone is retiring today.
Just to make sure that I'm understanding that, if we put in a cash infusion of $500 million today, okay, and then going forward 10 years, 20 years, the return on that $500 million, wouldn't that cut what our actual...
Oh, yes, yes. Now, assuming no one accrues additional benefits.
Right.
Assuming that, you know, the I don't want to say this, but assuming the plan were frozen today, no one accrued additional benefits, if you put in, you know, $500 million, that would grow with interest to the $1 billion in, you know, how many ever years?
When we have the breakdown, and I don't know exactly where it is, but isn't the larger revenue producer of this the returns on investment?
Yes,
and
sure.
And to a lesser extent, the employer and employee contribution?
Yes.
So therefore, if we had a higher cash infusion now, that would increase that percentage as well?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. The sooner you put in the money, the better it is in a pension plan, of course.
Okay.
Senator Krebsbaugh.
Senator Krebsbaugh.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Reese, we are now at 72% funded, I believe you said.
Yes.
What is a comfortable percentage to be at?
Well, that's a very good question. It depends on who you ask. I would say, you know, the ultimate goal is to get to 100%. So I would say 100%. But other folks believe 90% is probably a reasonable percent, again, because not everyone is retiring today. People are going to retire, you know, in the future over a period of time. 80% might, you know, if you ask other people, it might be 80%. I would tell you, just this is my own personal belief, I would say 90%. But again, the goal is to get to 100. But I would say 90% is very comfortable. Again, just my own personal belief. Does that help? All right.
Continue.
Okay. So we got the funded ratio results. Now we'll talk about the contribution rate results. So we've got, again, the very similar graph here. We've got, you know, the various columns represent the main system, judges, the two public safety plans, total PERS column, and then highway patrol. And if you look at, you know, the graphs, the blue and the red, you can kind of get a sense of, this is the total actuarially determined contribution rate. So for example, if you look at the first column, which is the main system, the 2017 actuarial contribution rate, and this includes employee contributions as well, so it's the total that's coming into the trust. The actuarially determined contribution rate was 18.2%. For main system, it's gone up to 18.25%. And so relatively speaking, that's a pretty level percentage increase, and that's, you know, we don't, if there were significant deviations, we would, you know, have to explain that, but the 18.2 to 18.25 is not too different, obviously. In terms of the judges plan, it's 12.81 last year. It's gone down this year to 10.03. The public safety plans, the contribution rate has gone down in both of those situations. The total PERS plan, so in terms of the total, it's gone from 18% for 2017 to 17.99. Again, very, very level. And then in terms of highway patrol, the highway patrol went from 39.21% in 2017 to 38.8%, so a slight decrease. So relatively speaking, the contribution rate has been fairly level from year to year, which is, generally speaking, the idea of the funding policy that you've adopted, the funding methodology, is to try to come up with a level percentage of pay contribution rate. So this is an important chart. This compares the statutory contribution rate that's coming into the fund, that's actually the fixed contributions that are actually flowing into the fund, with what we've determined to be the total actuarial contribution rate, the actuarially determined contribution rate. And so for main system, you can see that the red bar is the statutory rate, and then the blue bar is the actuarially determined contribution rate based on actuarial value of assets. So for the main system, you can see money's actually coming into the fund per the statute are 14.12% of pay. In fact, the total actuarial contribution rate is determined to be 18.25. So there's a deficit there. And I know you're all aware of that. In terms of the judges, the statutory rate is significantly in excess of the actuarially determined contribution rate. The same thing is true for the two public safety plans. The statutory rates are in excess of the actuarially determined contribution rate. Highway Patrol, however, has a deficit.
Senator
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry to interrupt, but...
No, not at all.
When the judges, which seems to be a pretty extreme overfunding there compared to the public safety, but is that what happened to the job service account, too? There was overfunded in certain years, and now it's overfunded and told us a closed account?
And it's closed, too. And it's closed as well.
Will the same thing happen to these accounts? Will they ever get to a point of closure then, or they won't be? They won't be closed at any point, but is the closure because of the overfunding or because the plan for that system goes away?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. Scott, do you know? Or Sharon?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Beckedahl, the job service plan was actually closed to new participants. They moved over into a different, actually their employees are now covered under PERS. So this was a plan that predated that, and so it was actually closed to any new participants in, I don't know, the 80s, I think. And so no new people can go into that. And so that would be different than like the judges where employees can continue.
So what happens to the excess accrued balance in the job service closed fund? Is that a federally protected fund, or does it come back to, is it an asset of PERS at some point, or? Talking about that closed fund, I don't understand it being a new member. So,
Mr. Chairman and Senator, my experience I'll kind of give you the experience I have with the plan that we were given the administration of. It was the OASIS plan, which was a very old plan that was established. And what happened there is that in that plan, at the end of the day, when the last beneficiary was paid, there were some assets left over, and those went back to the general fund. Now, with the job service plan, and this is probably a question that we maybe don't know the answer to yet, but it was a plan that was created through the Department of Labor and has some federal impact. So if at the end of the day, when that last beneficiary is paid out, because the assets will stay until that last beneficiary is paid out, if there are not assets left, I mean, if we're going to run out of money, we would have to come before the legislature to get an appropriation to pay those benefits. But if there is money left over, that will be a question for someone down the road as to whether that money will revert back to the federal government or whether it would go back to the state.
Sharon, I have one question for you.
Yeah.
So in terms of the job service plan, when the plan was frozen, did the statutory rate come down, or was it kept the same? Did you know?
Actually, in the job service plan, that one's not in statute. The contributions are established in a plan document, but I believe they quit funding it when they okay. That maybe predated me on okay. when we took over that plan. So. Okay.
So, but you're right. This, you know, in for example, the judges, the statutory rate is significantly in excess. So that would be something that you might want to consider in terms of changing that rate, reducing it. So, in terms of the unfunded liability, and we've really kind of talked a little bit about all of this. You know, in terms of what's been going on now. But in total, again, this is a very similar chart. Looks at all the plans, and we start with last year's unfunded actuarial liability, and then we end up with unfunded liability at the current valuation date, or July 1, 2018. So, for example, for Main System, the unfunded actuarial liability as of July 1, 2017, was $1.088 billion, and this year it's $1.089 billion. And similarly for judges, public safety. So, for example, the Main System, the unfunded, has gone up. Judges has a credit, an excess amount of money, and that excess has gone up, which is good. The public safety plans, the unfunded has been reduced. The public safety plan with prior service, it went from 12.3 to 11.2. The public safety plan without prior main service, that actually had a credit, and that credit has increased. Highway Patrol, the unfunded liability has also gone down. RHAC, the unfunded liability has also gone down. And job service, we'll talk about that in a minute. That excess has actually gone down, but the excess has gone down, meaning the unfunded has kind of increased a little bit. But again, that's the frozen plan. So in terms of what happened during the year, why are these results the way they are? Basically, all systems except job service had a decrease in the unfunded liability due to favorable asset experience. So the assets performed in excess of our assumption. All systems had decreases in the unfunded liability due to lower actual salary increases than assumed, which again is a gain, which reduces the unfunded liability. And those were offset slightly by the larger systems who had unfavorable demographic experience, meaning people retired earlier than assumed or less people terminated than assumed. It's a combination of all those factors. So that's kind of the reasons why. Yes.
Could you address the contribution for both the main system as well?
Yeah. Oh yes. Oh yeah. We're going there. Yes. So one reason why the unfunded liability increases is the fact that again, for main system, I'll use main system as an example. But main system, your statutory rate is not sufficient to cover the actuarial rate, And so generally speaking, you know, to the extent you have that shortfall, that's also going to increase the unfunded liability. And I'll go into that in some more depth as we go forward. So those are the results, the numerical results. I'm going to just go through kind of briefly here some summary comments on the results. And so we'll talk about main system first. This is on page 26. The actuarial contribution rate has increased from 18.2% to 18.25%. Not too bad, not too bad. But, you know, one of the reasons why is, as Scott just mentioned, the statutory contribution rate is lower than the actuarial contribution rate, which caused the actuarial contribution rate to increase. I mean, that's really the main factor. There was unfavorable plan experience, including data changes, higher benefits than projected for new retirees. I mentioned that, what I call the demographic changes. But then that was offset again by favorable experience in terms of the fund on a market value of assets basis earned about 9.1% compared to our assumption and 9.2% on an actuarial value of basis, actuarial value of assets basis. And last but not least, there were lower salary increases than assumed. So all of this, you know, combined experience increased the actuarial contribution rate from 18.2 to 18.25. But the key there is the fact that you're not contributing the actuarial contribution rate. The statutory rate is significantly lower. In terms of the funded ratio actually increased slightly. The funded ratio went from 69.9 to 71.6%. That's about a 2% increase. And the reason why the funded ratio went up is primarily investment return. And recognition, you know, when we do the smoothing of the actuarial value of assets, there was a component due to the deferred fiscal year 2017 asset gains that was recognized in the actuarial value of assets. So the good news is that, you know, from my perspective as your actuary, the contribution, the funded ratio increased, your contribution went up, but not too much. But the key, you know, takeaway here from this page is the fact that, and I have a chart in a few more pages that shows what's the impact of the fact that the statutory rate does not meet the actuarial determined rate. I've got a graph on that in a second. We'll go through the.
Mr. Chairman, Lance, that 18.25, is that based on a 20-year amortization?
Yes.
And did I see on a 30-year amortization, it might be more like 16?
Yes. Yeah, you're jumping. So you're jumping ahead. You jumped ahead already. You looked at this.
Okay.
No, we'll go through that. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. The statutory rate. I mean, we'll jump into it. The statutory rate is about 14.12, if I recall. The rate for let's see here. So on a 20-year amortization basis, your statutory rate is 14.12. On an actuarial basis, assuming amortization, 20 years amortization, the contribution rate would be 18.25%. And then on a 30-year, which we've also included some numbers here, I can't remember where that was in here. About 16.7% would be that would be 30-year amortization. That's open as well. Yeah. So the statutory rate is about 14.12. If you were to amortize the unfunded liability over 30 years, the actuarially determined contribution rate would be 16.7. And on a 20-year amortization basis, it's 18.25. Does that?
Yeah, that is, and the 16 is consistent with the bill that we're proposing to increase 1 and 1.
Right.
Am I going to see the number 4.05 in this presentation?
4.05? I don't know why. Where is that?
I don't know if this is the same presentation we saw last week at the PERS board meeting that Amy presented.
Oh, right, yes.
And that was the... normal costs, which I understand to be what the rate would need to be if we were 100% funded.
Oh, okay, I see. We took that out of this so as not to, you know, bore you with all the nitty-gritty details. So you won't see it here.
I anticipated the question I'd like to ask. Well, the point that I would like to make, I think, that we legislators on the defined benefit, before 2008, we were 4-4. If 4.05 is the cost that it was, or the necessary contribution if we were 100% funded,
mm-hmm.
then it seems to me that everything over that is for the purpose of restoring the fund.
Amortizing the unfunded, correct.
My concern is this. That's on the defined benefit side. We have employees on defined contributions who are getting the same contribution going into their personal fund. And as we increase that, then it increases on that side. If I was a new employee and had the option, I would go to defined contributions because that would be going into my account. So a difficult question that I have for you is this. If an individual defined contribution account through their career invested 4-4, would they at retirement be able to have a plan that would be the same as a defined benefit?
You know, that's a good question. It's a very
and there's a lot of variables I understand
yeah.
into that.
Yeah, there are.
People live different lengths.
Right. It really is represent. It really it's based on the answer to that question. Really is determined by the amount of the benefit that you get from the defined benefit plan.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, if it's a relatively good benefit, which I think you know your plans do produce good benefits. Generally speaking, the return on the investment, so to speak, for a defined benefit plan is better. Now, again, there's so many variables. It depends on the ultimate benefit. But generally speaking, the return on the investment for a defined benefit is better than the return on investment for a defined contribution. But again, it depends on the ultimate benefit that you're providing from the defined benefit plan. If that's a you know relatively sound, financially sound, secure retirement benefit, then my you know comment was that defined benefit plans are generally speaking more efficient vehicles to produce retirement security than a defined contribution. But again, it depends on the benefit. I mean, that's really the amount. You know, that's really the key. What is the benefit you're getting from the defined benefit plan? If it's very, very minimal, my answer might be slightly different, or would be different, I should say.
And it would seem to me that part of that answer would be if that person holding the individual account matched perfectly the average of all the assumptions that go into developing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if they got the same return, again, it really depends on what's the benefit from that defined benefit plan. As long, you know, if the returns were equal, which generally speaking, they're not. Generally speaking, if you look across, you know, all the industry information that comes out for defined benefit plans, 401k plans, individual retirement plans, is that, and again, I you know, this is kind of a generality, but generally speaking, participants do not make the appropriate investment decisions that a defined benefit plan with, you know, professional managers makes. So generally speaking, returns on individual 401ks, IRAs are less than professional managers make, you know, return in defined benefit plans. Again, that's totally a generality. But if all else was equal, if you earn the same, let's say you earn 7% in defined contribution, 7% in a defined benefit, it really is the key is what is the benefit in that defined benefit plan.
So would it be do current retirees depend on continuing revenues coming into the plan from active members?
Yes. Yes. Right now, yes. Because you have an unfunded liability.
So why are Social Security checks average $1,200?
I don't know.
And I guess the point of all my questions is, going forward, if we decide to go to a defined contribution, we should be looking at the contribution rate.
Yes.
That may not necessarily need to be as high as it currently is.
You know, I'd have to do that study. I mean, it's a fairly, you know, we could do that fairly simply to give you some idea of, you know, defined benefit versus defined contribution. You're saying given a 4 and 4 employee mm-hmm. contribution, a 4% of pay contribution by both employees and employers. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes.
When you say 4-4? We could do that comparison and compare it to, for example, the main system benefit and see what that might look like. To be honest, I don't want to give you an answer because I'm not sure of the answer right now.
One other interesting point is on the judge's plan with a few members in there, what would happen to the plan if the Chief Justice realized that his pension check would be bigger than his paycheck?
He might retire.
Continue.
All right. All right, so we're on to Highway Patrol. The actuarial contribution rate decreased from 39.21% to 38.8% for Highway Patrol, and the funded ratio increased by about 2% for Highway Patrol. The reasons here, you had good investment experience, and again, you had lower salary experience. However, again, with regard to Highway Patrol, the same comment, the statutory contribution rate is lower than the total actuarial contribution rate. So it's about 33% statutory versus 38.8% actuarially determined contribution rate. And so again, that is going to be significant going forward. This year you had experience that was more favorable and offset that fact. But going forward, to the extent that expectation for assumptions are met, that's going to be a problem. Let's see, the retiree health insurance health insurance credit fund. The actuarially determined employer contribution rate increased slightly from about 1.05% to about 1.09%. The statutory rate, however, is higher. It's 1.14%. So that's the good news there. The funded ratio increased by about 2%. Let's see, job service. So the in terms of the job service plan, the plan surplus decreased by about $4.4 million. And basically what happened here is we changed the actuarial investment return assumption due to a change in the asset allocation to get a little bit more conservative here. So that's why we had a prior investment return assumption of 5.7%, and we're now using 4.75%. So that actually increased the unfunded liability or decreased the surplus there. And so the funded ratio decreased from 154% to 144%. Again, a very, you know, still well over 100%, clearly. So in terms of recommendations, we just have a few here for you. The statutory employer contribution rates are lower for both, you know, as I've mentioned here, for Main System and Highway Patrol. We recommend that the statutory contribution rates be increased. You know, this is from an actuarially sound point of view, such as the unfunded liabilities amortized over a period of no longer than 30 years. 30 years would kind of be our cap. We wouldn't recommend anything longer than 30 years. Your current policy is 20 years. That's fine. We're good with anything lower than 30, but we wouldn't recommend anything higher than 30. And let's see. So the total actuarial contribution rates based on the 30-year amortization are 16.69 for Main System and 35.74 for Highway Patrol. And again, those compare to for the statutory rate for Main System is 14.12. We're suggesting or recommending that the statutory contribution rate be increased to at least 16.69, and the statutory rate for highway patrol is 33%, and we're recommending that it be increased to no lower than 35.74%, again, from an actuarially sound perspective. That's where our recommendations are coming. So the statutory employer contribution rate is significantly higher. This is for the judge's plan, and the funded ratio is now over 120%. And so given that, we recommend a decrease to the employer and or employee statutory contribution rate for judges. And what we're suggesting here is that the board could consider a policy in which the total contribution rate employer and employee is a certain percentage of the total normal cost. So generally speaking, you want to contribute normal cost because that's, you know, the liability keeps growing by the normal cost. That's the cost of benefits accruing during the year. And in order to be a little bit more conservative and hedge our bet there, instead of just putting in the normal cost, which is what you would need, to the extent there are gains or losses along the way, we suggest maybe 120% of normal cost to keep that that reserve, to keep a reserve there. Let's see, the job service, in terms of the job service plan, the investment return was lower than the reduced investment return assumption of 4.75. As I mentioned, the prior investment return assumption for job service is 5.7. We lowered that to 4.75. In fact, you're still earning less than that. So our recommendation here is consider whether an additional decrease in the assumption is appropriate. If we did decrease the investment return assumption, we you're currently at 140%. We still think that you would still be over 100% funded, even if we reduce, let's say, 4.75 to 4 or 3.5. You're still going to be over 100% funded. We had done a study on the RHIC participation, and we made some recommendations. That was a separate letter that we provided to the board, and we recommend some of those assumptions in that letter. We recommend that the board consider a 20-year amortization period for RHIC in calculating the actuarially determined contribution rate, which is the same as the other plans. All right, we're going to run through a couple projections here. So this is a projection, and we're looking forward now, forward-looking, for the main system. And as I said, you're about 72% funded. Unfortunately, because the statutory rate is less than the actuarially determined rate, the projected funded ratio actually depletes assets in 2106, which is so far, you know, out there. But the trend is, you know, as I mentioned earlier, you want to see an increase in the funded ratio. This is a decrease. And so this is something that, you know, we always look at. It's alarming. You want to fix that if, to the extent you possibly can. So that's kind of the bad news. Whoops. The good news, though, is the public safety. That plan is going from, this is public safety with prior main system service system. That's going from about 80% to over 100%. And the same thing with the public safety without prior main service. You're already over 100%, and that will continue to increase. So that's the good news. And that's pretty much all of the results. We have a couple pages here where we talk about summary of some board actions that the board has taken recently. We updated the economic assumptions. As I said, as of July 1, 2017, so for use in last year's valuation, we updated the actuarial equivalence factors that were first used effective October 1, 2017. We updated the service purchase methodology, which was first used effective January 1, 2018. We adopted a return to work methodology and adopted employer withdrawal liability methodology. Again, this is the board actions, not GRS actions, but in conjunction with our help. So I'm at, you know, open to questions. We've got the last few pages are just kind of the change in the funded status, you know, over time. You get a sense of what happened. Again, happy to answer any questions.
Any comments or questions?
I know you've asked a lot of questions throughout, so that's great.
Senator Beckedahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so I'm going back to a slide. Let me find the number here. Thirty, Our current contributions are about 14% employee-employer in the main system, a little over 14%, is that correct?
Yes, for the main system, yes.
And you're recommending we get to the 16, was it 16.69?
Yes.
So if the legislature adopts the 1-1 increase that we talked about yesterday, we'll be over 16%, but not at the 16.9. That would be advantageous in your opinion?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And the same thing with the Highway Patrol and the safety?
Yes.
There would be a 2% gain there, I believe, with yep. what we talked about yesterday?
Yes.
Putting us very close to the
yes.
recommendation?
Absolutely, yep.
You know, there's no increase for Highway Patrol.
Oh, there isn't?
Proposed.
We're just talking about the main,
just main
system?
Just the main. The Highway Patrol is still projected to get to 100% eventually, just not within the actuarially reasonable time period.
Okay.
Whereas PERS is never projected right. to get to 100%.
So we would stay below what he's recommending for the Highway Patrol, though, and this public safety, then. We're still about 2 percentage points below, but long-term the system would fund itself, you're saying?
Under the current actuarial assumptions.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much.
Any comments from the public? Any comments from the public? Okay. Any further committee discussion? Okay. As a reminder again, we are a statutory committee, so we will not sign or die. We will meet during the organizational session in regard to the bills that we took jurisdiction over yesterday and any other business that might come before the committee. And I'm sure we'll have some TFFR and PERS updates at that time, especially on their legislative agenda, which will be finalized by then. And then the chair would entertain a motion for Senator Nelson to make a motion to direct legislative council and the chair to provide a report to the legislative management on the November 14th and 15th meetings.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Nelson.
I move that you prepare a report for the legislative committee and we adjourn until your next call to a meeting.
There's a motion. Is there a second? Any further discussion? Hearing none, we can approve that on voice vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carried. Okay, meeting adjourned. Thank you.